subtract. So I want to invite you to just take a few moments to sense the body, not to really think about it, but just explore how there is a sense of a body. It could be the pressure of the buttocks on the cushion or chair. Maybe even noticing the qualities of that pressure. Is it change? Is it pleasant, unpleasant? You might notice how the body is expanding on the in-breath and contracting on the out-breath, and just noticing how it does this all the time, all on its own. And there's an energetic quality to the breathing process, with the energy level increasing on the in-breath and a dropping down, a relaxation on the out-breath. Really, how do you even know where the boundaries are between this body and what we tend to think of as what's outside of it without the visual map? You might notice whether there's any thoughts or emotions occurring, and did it take any effort for on your part, on some I, to make them happen? Do they change? So does it take any effort to hear the voice, to understand what the voice is saying? And so when you're ready, if your eyes are closed, please open them. So, Monday, I was at Harvard Vanguard getting urine tests, blood tests, x-rays, wondering whether I was going to be here this evening. And Tuesday night, I was in incredible pain, and I thought, you know, in fact, I just thought, God, can I bear this another minute, and then it'd be okay, and then come back. And I'm not telling all this to get sympathy from someone, but it's so relevant to what I want to talk about this evening. It's our kind of ungroundedness. As Joseph Goldstein, one of his phrases I love so much, anything can happen anytime. And the Pali word for the situation is anicca, which is usually translated as impermanence, but some teachers and translators prefer inconstancy, unreliability. That's the nature of this life that we call ours. There's nothing we can really hold on to. And so, you know, part of what I'm referring to as gates to freedom might not seem so cheery, but actually seeing through that, developing some disenchantment or dispassion to it, is in fact a way to freedom. And I ask, you know, to explore just some sense of what the body is, whether you have the body, who's listening. This is another gate to freedom, this sense of seeing through this sense of identity, this sense of self. And this is probably the most challenging aspect of this practice. The beauty of the anicca part is it's pretty obvious to us. We're quite clear on a macro level that we're all going to get old, sick, and die. And certainly the sickness parts, even if you're young, is pretty obvious. But the not-self stuff, or which some people like to translate as no-self, anatta, but I prefer the translation not-self. And it's interesting that Buddha really never said whether it's a self or not a self. So you might wonder, I think it's quite a reasonable thing to wonder, well, why is all this teaching of not self, what's that referring to? And of course, if everything is inconstant and unreliable, and I'll be careful here, because actually it's referring to everything that's conditioned is inconstant and reliable, then ultimately nothing is inherently satisfactory. These are the so-called three marks of existence. Not self, anicca, inconstant, unreliable, and unsatisfactory. Which, how do you ever sell something like this? I don't know. You know, the mythological story of the Buddha seeing old age, sickness, and death, and that's called the heavenly messenger, so that's a good marketing trick. I know Madeline Klein teaches courses on that, and I just don't know if I could call it the heavenly messengers. But really, it was what motivated him to go out and see if there was something beyond this, some kind of freedom. So about this time a year ago, towards the end of July, I was at the center on a Thursday meditating. I took a walk with my good friend Jerry Bass, who's 68, was 4 years younger than me. And we had a nice conversation. We've been very deep friends for a long time. And we came back to the center and hugged goodbye. And I thought I'd have a long time with Jerry. And about a month later, I came to the center, and his daughter told me that he had this one-in-a-million disease called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. It's a disease that basically eats the brain like a sponge, and he had 2 years to live. And so Jerry came to the center for the last time, and we all had lunch with him. A lot of people from the center came. And, you know, his mind had really deteriorated. A friend of mine fed him his meal. He couldn't eat anymore. I fed him dessert. And at one point, Madeline Klein, who teaches here, said, "Jerry, we love you." And he said, "Well, this is a pretty smart group." So even though he was going through this, you know, he knew what was happening. He hadn't lost that much of his faculties. He had some peace about it all. And he said, "It is what it is." And that is, life is what it is. It's living itself, and it doesn't go by our agenda, all the things we think it should be. I had two friends who died of pancreatic cancer in their 40s. And what struck me about them was it wasn't that they were bitter about it. What they told me was it really made them see what was important. So this reflection on that anything could happen any time, that death is certain, the timing is uncertain, what is important, is really a helpful aspect of practice. It certainly frames things like when your car gets smashed up by somebody or something, like, well, relative to death, yeah, okay. Or someone insults you. My wife and I have this practice of every time we say goodbye, we do it like it's the last time. That's every day, sometimes more than once a day. For a long time, my practice was to do everything like it was the last thing I would ever do. And it is. It is the first thing and the last thing we'll ever do. So reflection on death isn't always a good way to go in practice. It depends on where one is. When I first came here, for some reason, Larry encouraged me to go practice with Zen Master, and I went to listen to the Zen Master give a talk at Cambridge Zen Center. And the Zen Master's father had just died. And he talked about the experience of his father dying. And he said his father was really a really bright man. He was a professor, law professor emeritus at Yale. He's also an alcoholic. And when his father knew he was going to die, he opened up. he really opened up to his vulnerability and really connected like he had never connected before. And in some sense, I think when we think about just our own vulnerability, our own frailty, could we drop our mask and really connect? To drop all these images, this sense of identity that we have to create that's solid, that somehow is good enough. What would that be like? And then actually when he found out he was getting better, he closed down again. When I came here, I've been practicing for a while, and I signed up for Larry Rosenberg's course on death. And after the first class, we were supposed to reflect on death, and I came back the second class and said, well, dying doesn't seem so bad. It actually seemed like a good idea to me. That's where I was when I came to practice, even after quite a few years. I was kind of depressed. There's this existential angst, what's life all about? We flash in and out of existence. It wasn't surprising. I wasn't particularly at ease. I was totally stressed out, working 80, 90 hours a week, trying to live up to all these expectations that society sets for us in terms of work, who I should be, what I should be like. And so I'd be stressed out for the whole week, and then I'd run off to the mountains, and ground myself, come back into my body, and I'd be okay, you know. I would actually be sick, and I'd start climbing mountains, and I'd feel whole again. And so much of this practice is to move out of this conceptual way we're in the world. We don't see how vibrant it is. We don't see how rapidly things are changing. And being in the body is such an important aspect of this. It's our ground. It's the place that discharges our emotions. It's their sense of presence, of here-ness. But for many people, I think, because they might not be in a... I mean, I'm not suggesting one start by reflecting on death. A huge part of this practice is to cultivate a sense of ease. I mean, that's for me was the peace when I came to this practice. I could really find this wonderful place of refuge by just coming into my body, being with my breath. It was a place of a real refuge. And for other people, it might be loving kindness practice or compassion practice or renunciation, just simplifying our life. And this is an aspect of practice to take on perhaps for a very long time until one feels somewhat healed, to become more whole. But ultimately, we can't line things up. No matter how well we take care of ourselves, no matter how wise we are about how we live, things happen. And, you know, the Buddha's view on this anicca, this inconstancy, unreliability, impermanence, I mean, he thought it was really important. His dying words supposedly were, all conditioned things are impermanent, strive on. And while we're sitting and meditating, we might ask what we're supposed to be doing. And, you know, the discourse on mindfulness, the Satipatthana discourse, is really about seeing impermanence. The first focus of mindfulness is to be with the body, to explore, to see its inconstant nature, to see that pleasant experiences come and go, the unpleasant experiences come and go, that emotions come and go, that thoughts come and go. It's really a focus of practice to see this. And the purpose of seeing this is to have some disenchantment with it, to see that there's really nothing we can hold on to. So what actually motivated this talk for me tonight was a chant that is done quite often in meditation centers. And I used to do the chant all the time, but didn't give it a tremendous amount of thought, which is kind of amazing, but I'm sort of a deluded type. So the chant, in the translation of the chant, is all conditioned things are impermanent. Their nature is to arise and pass away. Living in harmony with this truth brings the greatest happiness. And, you know, if you're chanting this all the time, you might ask, well, how does this do this? And what does it mean to live in harmony with this truth? And what are conditioned things? Is there an unconditioned? So conditioned is a translation of the Pali word sankhara. It's such a core, crucial aspect of the Buddhist teaching. And it's used in many ways. One way is a sort of an active sense. It's something that makes things. Sankharas are kind of co-doings, things that do things together, make things together. In another sense, it's just things that are a combination of conditions. So I'm going to just focus on that tonight because we might have 45 minutes or so. We are the coming together. What we think of ourselves are the coming together of conditions. What we think of ourselves, there's nothing solid here. And conditions are always changing. So what one model, I mean, the Buddha had all these different models, just different conceptual ways to look at things and then explore them. But not to just think about them, to actually explore them experientially. Can you see this? So one model is what's called the five aggregates. That what we are the coming together of this body. And really, body is kind of like when you start exploring what the body is like, it's not some big lumpy visual image we have. It's quite complex. I was particularly interested in intestines. I was kind of laughing at myself. I was looking at images of intestines, given what was going on with me, you know? I mean, well, is that what you are? So the body, and then there's something called feeling, perceptions, and consciousness, and they're all linked together. So feelings are just whether things are pleasant or unpleasant. It could be an emotion, it could be a physical sensation. So it's not an emotion, it's just this sense of this is pleasant, this is not pleasant. And perceptions are the way we separate out things. The way we distinguish one person from another, the way we distinguish the cushion from the zabuton, the way we just break things apart, which is something the mind does. And we assume that that's the way the world is, but it's just the way our perceptual system works, the way we learn to interpret things. So every moment, there's what's called contact. And contact is when a sense door, there are five senses, and from a Buddhist perspective, the mind is just another sense door, contacts some object. So for example, you're all sitting here, the eyes see me up here, so the sense door are the eyes, I'm the object, and there's a knowing of that, which is consciousness. So consciousness in this sense is a very simple idea. It's not something like primordial consciousness, it's just this knowing that occurs moment to moment from contact. So from contact, feeling and perceptions arise. And then from feeling and perceptions, more complex, what are referred to the other aggregate or mental formations, which are emotions, thoughts, they arise out of contact. And then the feeling and perceptions, I really like this, I want it. This is really pleasant, I want to hold on to it. It just all arises out of the sense of contact. We see something, we hear some view, we don't approve of it, there's a pushing away. So what we are, from the Buddhist perspective, and I can't go into this too much tonight, is the coming together. One way to look at it is what we are, the coming together of this body, feeling, perceptions, consciousness, and mental formations. And they're changing all the time, rapidly. And because of that, they're inconstant, unreliable. We can never line things up to be okay. So the problem is much deeper than old age, sickness, and death. It's a moment-to-moment experience. And the question is, do we live that way? my attitude for a very, very long time, and I remember actually asking one time when I was in a retreat, I said, the guy's talking about all these desires. Desires are, it's really kind of craving, clinging. He said, you know, that's the cause of suffering. And I said, well, what are we supposed to do with them? And he said, well, there's not much you can do unless you have something else. But he didn't tell me what the something else was. So I thought, oh, you know, I thought, okay, everything's impermanent, unreliable, but I want as much of the good stuff as I can get. Isn't that how we live? Because we don't know there's something else. And the Buddha's saying there is something else. There's an unconditioned. If there's a conditioned, there has to be unconditioned. So what we tend to do is think of things arise, they exist for a while, and they pass away. And the Dalai Lama says this is where we're holding on. We're not seeing the radical nature of change. There's a visual experience. There's a sense. There's a touch experience. There's a hearing. I mean, they're just changing radically. So nothing exists for a while. It's changing like that. It's really vibrant. And what we do is we move up into the head and we conceptualize. We have some idea about life. We have some idea about a good emotion, about an idea which will fill us up. And so we miss how vibrant it is, and we're trying to hold on to something that's just like standing in quicksand. So I think it's just, I would encourage you maybe to really explore what effect it would have on your life if at a cellular level you knew this was the case. There really isn't anything you can line up. I mean, when I talked about emotions back in July, you know, one of the things I said, we just open up to them and we notice they come and go. And it's not just because it's really hard to open up to them. But that's the practice, to get enough strength, enough stability to be able to do that. When I was at the, quite a few years ago, I was at the Forest Refuge for, I guess, about 6 weeks, and I was with Joseph Goldstein, and he had me just do impermanence the whole 6 weeks. And so I got up in the morning, and, you know, when you're meditating, you don't need a lot of sleep. I get up around 3 or 4, I go out and look at the beautiful sky and the stars, and I was usually in March and April, so it'd be nice and crisp, and then there's a place I go. I can actually almost reveal it now because I don't go there anymore. But there's a nice place I go where nobody seems to know about, or only a few people. And I'd make a cup of tea, and I'd go to this place, and I'd have the tea, and then I'd sit. And I remember one morning, I took a sip of this tea, and it was good, but it was so ephemeral. You know, that taste was there for a moment, and then it's gone. And it just really was so obvious to me because I was just, this was my 6 weeks of watching impermanence. And then I'd sit and we'd have breakfast, you know. And then so when I'd eat the meal, you'd take a bite, there's taste there, it rises, it's there for a little bit, and it's gone. You finish the meal, and I sort of think, oh, that was really good. Maybe I'll have another bite, you know, get another little small. And if I did, it didn't last very long. And if I didn't, the desire to have it didn't last very long either, because I was sort of moving on into some other aspect of my day. So you go through the whole day like that. You get up, you have this meal, food, taste arises by it, pass away, you get up, you go do something, go sit, walk, not very exciting, right? And then after lunch, I would always go for a walk in the woods. And of course, it was really cold, and we've been inside this nice, warm meditation center. And so there's this unpleasant sense out there, and it's really cold, walking in the snow in March. And then I'd be walking up a hill, and by then my body's got acclimated, and next thing you know, I'm sweating. And I come back, I feel good, I had a nice walk, you know, maybe by evening, feeling tired, unpleasant emotions, moods. Just observe your day what it's like, moment to moment. It's like, think about what your yesterday was like. How much of it do you really remember? I mean, experientially, it's like a dream. So I was going to read something from Anne-Marie Lindbergh, Gifts from the Sea, about love, but I think I'm going to run out of time, so I'll read it in the Q&A if we have time, or maybe if I have time at the end of the talk, I'll talk about it. But it had to do with my wife and I's wedding vows, actually. We were wise because we're both divorced. So we didn't have some idea that this is going to be some relationship that was going to be necessarily the same and lasting forever, but it turns out it's lasted a long time. But, you know, it's the case that everything changes. Relationships come and go. Jobs. People praise us, blame us. Feel good one moment, not so good the next moment. About a month ago, someone hit my car out here, and I know some people have heard about this. It was amazing, actually, because it bugged me. It really did. Yeah, it's a nice car. It hasn't been beat up. It's relatively new. And someone at the center did it. And they didn't leave a note, and I even knew who it was, and then they denied it to the insurance company, right? And the choice is, relative like my son's $80,000 orthodontic bill, this is like, excuse me, you know? But there was this shouldn't happen. Of course it happens all the time. And I think this is kind of a pointer to, I mean, and there's a wonderful story about a wooden boat. I meant to look it up, but I've forgotten about it. But basically someone's in a boat, and another boat's coming towards him. And he gets really upset because the boat's cutting him off. He starts yelling and everything, and then he sees the boat's empty. And, oh, no problem. So, you know, where does this, how does this help us? I mean, is it really, if everything's changing, you know, if the car is going to get hit, you know, Ajahn Chah says, my cup is already broken. If we take this attitude towards our life, maybe we don't get ruffled so much. And sometimes really serious things happen. How do we work with that? About a month ago, my son was out in Portland, Oregon, trying to decide where he's going to move there. And he calls me the day before he's supposed to come back. I don't know, or day of, I don't know. And he says, I fell off a 10-foot wall, and I can't walk. And so I talked with him a little bit. He didn't know what to do, and I arranged for insurance stuff, you know, to go see the emergency thing. And I really tried to limit what I did so that he could just take care of himself. You know, it's just like the ideal way to behave from my perspective. Then I got off the phone, and I thought, you know, what's going to happen to this kid, you know? How damaged is he? And the truth is, there's nothing I can do about it. It's going to be what it's going to be. But often what happens when we have something that we don't want to happen to us, there's aversion to it. And so even we know, oh, I'm upset, there's upsetness about this. There's concern, there's worry, there's fear. It still has a real punch to it. I mean, I've had it so many times where totally aware, And the thing that, this is really important, when you have these difficult experiences, just to notice if there's some subtle sense of aversion, some clinging to it. Sometimes it's some sense of an identity. This is happening to me. To see that. The story that kind of keeps us from holding on to it. Rather than to find a way to open up to experience and let it flow through us. And this is why it's so important to practice and develop steadiness of attention. Because if we don't, we easily slip up into this way we've lived our whole lives. So for my case, I could see, oh, I'm projecting all the stuff that's coming out. And there's this sense of, don't want it to be this way. And when you can really open to it, when you see through the aversion, this compassion just arises. There's a real caring that can take place, something that's helpful. So this sense of self really wants something to hold on to. It wants security. It wants to feel solid. Even if holding on to it is something unpleasant, it's better than not existing, of being nothing. So we can maybe even hold on to a sense of being an inadequate person, depressed person. This is what I am. Often in order to have some ground to hold on to things, we engage in compulsive ways. We try and make ourselves feel real in the world, maybe accomplishing things, to make a lot of money, fame, sex, power, causes. This is in some sense what the Buddha called coming. It's how we create some sense of identity. People want to leave a legacy. But the holding on creates a sense of fear, friction. We're always trying to line things up. It's like sitting on a three-legged stool, and the legs are all different lengths. And what we don't see is all the stress and discomfort of trying to arrange things so they work. So, why does this happen? In some sense, the whole nervous system creates a sense of me. It's a fabrication. It's a coming together of these aggregates. And there's a little program there, and there says, "Ah, this is me. This is happening to me." But where is the me? Can you find it anywhere? Can you find anything that's unchanging? I'm not saying the Buddha never said there's self or not self. He just said that these aggregates, don't cling to them as self, because they're constantly changing. So, you know, the whole idea of how one defines self is actually a complex thing. And the Buddha was really quite smart about this. He just wouldn't answer the question, is there a self or not a self? Won't talk about it. But what he did say is, these clinging aggregates, don't hold on to them as self, because it causes suffering. Don't hold on to your emotions as you, just open to the emotions, their life playing out. Don't even hold on to mistakes we make or great achievements we make as ourselves, because no matter how good you do, some point, you know, you have to keep on doing good to keep feeling good about yourself. And at some point, you won't do so well. And I think part of the reason we do this, and part of my frustration, I remember when asking the question about, well, what are we supposed to do with all this, you know, this wanting to be something, wanting to have pleasant experiences, wanting to, you know, not have unpleasant experiences. What was so unhelpful for me is there wasn't a pointing to something else. And the something else is to open to our groundlessness, to this fact that what we are is something that's beyond self, space, and time. That we're a manifestation of coming together of conditions. Not we are, but all there is are coming together conditions. And we're not separate from that. We're whole. We're complete. And the reason we need to do all these things, accomplish all these things, be all these things, is a sense of lack, that we don't feel complete because, you know, this little mind-body complex that flashes in and out of existence that can just at any moment have something happen to us, how can it possibly be complete? The problem is it's a fabrication, it's a construction of the mind. And so of course it doesn't feel grounded, because it's not real. It's a conceptualization. So much of the Buddhist teaching was to get people out of this whole framework of thinking. What's what got me to this practice in the first place? The Zen master said, thinking will get you nowhere. And it just so resonated with me after, you know, studying all this existential philosophy and all this sort of stuff. I thought, you can go anywhere with this. But, not thinking at all. What would that be like? To be with this moment-to-moment vibrancy. And so at first, I think the sense is, it's actually a really breakthrough just to be able to step back and be aware that there is this capability all human beings have of stepping back and being aware of what's going on. So is that you? The awareness is watching? If the awareness can see what's going on, are you what's going on, or are you the awareness? Madeline Klein and I did a workshop on the inner critic. I noticed she's doing it again now. Who is this inner critic? Where is it? It's in the mind, isn't it? It's one part of the mind talking to the other part of the mind. If we were outside the mind, we can control things, we could fix them. But we're not. We're being held within the mind as a mental concept. And so one part of mind fighting the other part of mind just creates some form of resistance, of stress. And that's why so much of practice is just simply opening to what's there, stopping the struggle. In some sense, that's the truest form of love we'll ever know. Just this awareness, this tender, empathic awareness that's fine no matter what's going on. It's peace in the midst of non-peace, comfort in the middle of discomfort. And that's what we really want to look for, is this sense of peace. So I want to, looks like I might have time for this quote from Gifts from the Sea. But I want to read two others first. This is from Teijitsu, who's an 18th century abbess in a monastery in Japan. She saw that all phenomena arose, abided, and fell away. She saw that knowing this, itself arose, abided, and passed away. So all phenomena arising away, and the knowing itself of it arises, abides, and passes away. And then she knew there was nothing more than this, no ground, nothing to lean on, stronger than the cane she held. Nothing to lean on at all, and no one leaning. And she opened the clenched fist of her mind and let go, and fell into the midst of everything. And that's what happens when we stop trying to line things up, trying to do something, trying to become something, even trying to be awakened. For a long time, it takes some effort, but at some point, I remember Doug Phillips gave a talk, if you think you still have a practice after you've been doing this for 20 years, you really need to kind of look at this. Because actually the freedom comes from not doing, just simply being. The sense of presence, of here-ness, of non-separation. So I want to read another little thing. It's from one of the Udanas, one of the Pali discourses, that kind of points a little bit to what this unconditioned might be. So it says, for one who clings, motion exists. So clinging could be clinging to anybody's aggregates. Because when you cling to an aggregate, you're kind of creating a sense of time. You're trying to get somewhere, get rid of something. So for one who clings, motion exists. But for one who clings not, there is no motion. Where no motion is, there is stillness. And this stillness is something that's hard to express, but if you talk about people about the awakening experience, they probably would say something like, it's like stillness. And what does that mean? It means the mind doesn't move. It's not fabricating, constructing, telling all these stories about how the world should be, how I should be. It's just there. I shouldn't say just there. It is there. It just isness. So where stillness is, there is no craving. Where no craving is, there is neither coming nor going. So this coming and going is referring to how we create a sense of identity. We create a sense of identity by trying to become someone, coming, right? And then we want to, then all of a sudden our attention shifts and we want to become something else, or we want to become the person that's eating an ice cream cone, and then we have that. That's becoming, and then we die, the sense of what we are dies, in the sense of the person eating the ice cream cone, and we want a person who says, gee, I wish I hadn't eaten that. Right? That's the sense of this identity is getting created over and over and over again. It's not something constant. It's created by trying to get things and get rid of things. So he's saying, when we're not clinging, we're not craving, there's stillness, and when there's stillness, there's no coming and going, there's no sense of identity. There's no sense of someone outside the experience. So it goes on. So now there's no person coming going. Where there's neither coming nor going, there is neither arising nor passing away. So the whole notion of time, the psychological time, is a construction, a fabrication. There's memory. This is how things were, but memories aren't right. I mean, I once gave a talk where I talked about how I had this memory, but my path in this, I never hesitated in this practice. That's my memory. My wife has a different memory. So our memories aren't so accurate. So that there's this memory of the past, and there's a fabrication of a future. It isn't really is what could happen, what might happen. But it's happening now. It's an imagined future. All there is this very momentary experience we have, this very now experience. So when there's no clinging or craving, there's no coming and going, no birth and death, moment to moment, there's no rising and passing away. Where there's neither rising nor passing away, there's neither this world, nor that world, nor a world in between. So this world refers to the sense door, the sense experience, contacting the sense object, which is that world, and no world, nothing in between, is the consciousness, the knowing of it. What he's saying is when there's no clinging, no craving, there's no coming or going, there's no past or future, there's just now, and there's no one knowing. There's no subject, no object, and nothing in between. This is like, in some sense, the core teaching of Buddha. There's no separation. We're so complete. This whole fabricated mind constructs a sense of someone who's having an experience. So this is truly the end of suffering. That's the way this discourse ends. So we have a few minutes, so we'll go back to Anne-Mara Lindbergh. These are my wedding vows, my second marriage, and I remember we went to another wedding later of one of my wife's cousins, and they read the same vows. And I said, they're really beautiful. She said, yeah, they were our wedding vows. Oh. So here's a go. She says, when you love someone, you do not love them all the time in exactly the same way, from moment to moment. It is an impossibility. It is even a lie to pretend to. And yet this is exactly what most of us demand. We have so little faith in the ebb and flow of life, of love, of relationships. We leap at the flow of the tide and resist in terror its ebb. So we leap at the flow of the tide and we resist in its terror its ebb. We are afraid it will never return. We insist on permanency, on duration, on continuity, when the only continuity possible in life as in love is in growth, in fluidity, in freedom. In the sense that the dancers are free, barely touching as they pass, but partners in the same pattern. The only real security is in not owning or possessing, not even demanding or expecting, not in hoping even. Security in relationship lies neither in looking back to what was in nostalgia, nor forward to what it might be in dread or anticipation, but living in the present relationship and accepting it as it is right now. Relationship must be like almonds. One must accept them for what they are here and now within their limits. Almonds surrounded, interrupted by the sea, and continually visited and abandoned by the tides. So I think I'll end with just a comment on this notion of acceptance, which I think sometimes people have problems with. You know, actually, acceptance means to receive, to open to. It's not a sense of resignation, or it's just really receiving this moment the way it is. Okay. All right, so I think I'll end the talk here. And just open up for questions.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.